Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm here in New York and joined by Carl Swanson, editor-at-large of New York Magazine. During his 14 years there, he's been senior editor, news editor and culture editor. He's been involved with Vulture.com, their art and culture sister website, and the news website, The Daily Intelligencer. He's also played a key role in shaping their shift toward being an award-winning digital media company. Carl, thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, your role encompasses New York Magazine, Vulture, The Cut websites. How do you break it down on a daily basis? If there was a kind of pie chart of how you spent your time, what would be the pieces of the pie?
You know, it kind of depends on what's needed. I mean, the magazine, you know, has a different pace, obviously, because especially now that we are every other week instead of being a weekly magazine, which it was for most of the time I was there, you know, those projects are longer, they're more intensive, they're more sort of fussed over. Usually what I will do when I'm working on the websites are that I kind of come in because there's something that they need help on, or because I have an idea that I'm sort of perfect to sort of, you know, make sure it happens. So that's kind of how it works.
So what's a typical week then? How do you actually break it down in terms of, are you reacting to stuff? Are you consulting and working on strategy, or is it writing, editing?
It all really kind of depends on what's happening. I mean, you know, sometimes, you know, again, like the Daily Intelligencer, you know, is basically a series of columnists as well as some sort of you know, news summary, you know, kind of aggregation with attitude. And I'm not really involved in that, not at this point. I was at one point, but I'm not really now. So that kind of operates on its own. Now, so I will come in if there's a project that needs, you know, outside of their sort of like very sort of intensive, you know, metabolism. I will sometimes come in and help them a little with that. Same thing with, you know, with Vulture. I was involved in an effort to sort of increase the amount of art coverage that we did. And for a while we were thinking about, oh, you know, could we actually run like a separate art website that sort of, you know, and in the end, actually, it didn't have the scale that we needed. But there was something that, you know, something else that I was involved in. It's interesting because New York Magazine, unlike I think a lot of places, that has you know, it has sort of a legacy publication, and then they try to sort of come up with as much, you know, digital content they can, much more oftentimes it would ever fit within the print publication. What we did, and we made a very intentional decision to do this, is to create separate organizations, separate brands,
The Cut, Vulture, et cetera.
Yeah, but at the same time, the magazine is sort of the best of, in some ways, that. I mean,
I've been a reader for years. I absolutely love it.
So every time you write something or you do a project, it will, a bigger project, you will, and it ends up in print. It also has a life online, you know, that I think in many people, like, you'll write something, and many times it will end up on The Cut, and people have no idea that it also appeared, other than a little tagline if they bother to read it, in the print publication. You know, so it's a very, you sort of end up working for all of these different organizations within the organization, and some of it ends up, you know, in the print magazine, but it doesn't necessarily have to, of course.
But the group as a whole took an interesting approach to the challenge that digital presented, because, you know, you had New York Magazine, you could have just had newyorkmagazine.com and just had an online version, got yes, the clicks and so on. But creating these different brands within it in their own right, that was quite a daring thing to do.
It was. I mean, you know, when you look back at the history of our website, and I've been there long enough to remember when before these other websites existed, you know, it was a place to look for restaurants. It was a very local website, and also curiously, it had a lot of our traffic was fashion shows, like slideshows of like the New York Fashion Week, because at some point we just didn't put that stuff behind a paywall, but other people had. So if someone was looking for a fashion show from, you know, a few years ago, they would look it up. And out of that, they decided they would build these different separate digital brands, with the assumption that, you know, that if you're a fan of pop music, you won't necessarily look to New York Magazine as a brand, as a place to look for that. I mean, the magazine, the old magazine, the magazine that, you know, that is sort of the legacy, isn't, you know, it had a very particular history. I mean, it came out of a particular era of New York City, and in every way, you know, and it was sort of defining what a new city meant. But in this era of this digital era of sort of, you need to sort of be able to scale something like that, something that really focuses on what the latest restaurant is in New York City, or even the sort of micro celebrities of New York City, wouldn't really make sense. That said, one of our micro celebrities is now running the Free World. And it's a peculiar thing, because he definitely was a character in the old New York Magazine. He was on the cover of dozen times. You know, it was just really a and, you know, I've spoken to him on the phone. He was very easy to get on the phone. He would call up this woman named Norma Forderer, who was his assistant. And we said, we want to get Donald Trump on the phone. And he would say whatever you needed him to say. And I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of New York City publications, who ought to have known him really well, didn't take his rise that seriously at first, because you were just sort of like, oh, yeah, it's Donald Trump. You know, what does that even mean? But anyway, that's kind of like that
well,
is.
Boy, has that
kind
come to bite us in the ass now?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'm going to ask you about Donald Trump in a second because I'm going to try and have some structure to this
okay.
this podcast.
Yes,
but I wanted to talk about what you're doing now and also your journey into the magazine and what you've done over the last 10 years. But in terms of what you're doing now, then you were talking about being assigned to various initiatives and so on.
Yes,
I had imagery of kind of, you know, Winston Wolfe from Pulp Fiction, that you're the troubleshooter. Is that the kind of thing that you do? Are you more a kind of editorial strategist now?
Sometimes, yes. And sometimes also, you know, I'm somebody who can, you know, who can, if we have a special issue we need to have, you know, done, I can come in and help put it together. I can, you know, have a certain amount of institutional memory. I have a certain amount of, you know, understanding sort of the tone and sort of like what people expect. So I was involved, like, with
the voice of the brand.
To some extent, yes. You know, and that's also in ways that I help with a certain amount of our, you know, I'm on the team of people that come up with our cover lines and sort of trying to discuss what a good sort of cover is for the magazine now. So these are the kinds of things that I'm involved in.
And if it's not too fawning a question, it sounds to me like you've got the ideal job within the whole company, really, because you've got your fingers in all the right pies. You're doing all the things that you're good at and that are exciting.
I love for people to have that impression. no, I mean, I'm very fortunate to have been there and to have had the support of the editor and and be able to sort of involved in a lot of different things. It's kind of what you want to be in journalism for. I mean, what you want to do is to find out about things and then sort of help other people understand things.
So it's been 14 years that you've been at the magazine. Tell us how you came to join them and tell us, give us some of the highlights and lowlights of the last 14 years.
Well, I came in because I was writing, at the time I was writing freelance. And I started my career at the New York Observer, and I used to write the media column for the New York Observer. And I used to hassle Adam Moss, who's currently the editor-in-chief of New York Media. And so we kind of got to know each other, sort of sparring over various things that he didn't want me to write about the New York Times and that kind of thing. And at the time, he was running the Times Magazine, and then he had a broader sort of portfolio there. And so, you know, when I was writing freelance for them, and when the magazine was bought and was taken over by the Wasserstein's, and they brought him in, I basically asked him for a job, and he hired me as a contract writer, and then I kind of weaseled my way in as an editor, and you know, as the sort of ultimately the role I have today.
So you weaseled your way in,
yes.
But you've managed to weasel your way remaining there. That analogy doesn't work at all. But anyway, we'll carry on. So what have you been going through? What have you been doing over the last 14 years?
You know, when it was a weekly magazine, I was involved in the front of the book, and that was sort of the quicker paced material, the stuff that would sort of close on Friday. You know, to come out on Monday. There was a time, and this seems so, so very long ago, that you would actually look on a Monday morning for a magazine for information, new information, fresh information.
Those were the days.
It's so strange.
You wouldn't even look at a newspaper now for that. You go to Twitter.
No, exactly. And when you do look at the newspaper, you look through it and you go, oh, you know, I read all this.
Well, you're looking for a different take on it, actually, aren't you?
Yes.
You don't want to be told what's happened. You know that already. It's
right.
What's their view on what's happened. It's the lens, I say.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. But even then, you probably write about it on your phone. So that was what I was involved in, and then increasingly it became apparent that you know, that really wasn't going to be viable. And I was also for a while working on the culture section, and that was interesting because one of the things that we were trying to do was at that point Vulture was going, but it wasn't quite as robust as it is now. We didn't sort of do all the things that we do, and we certainly didn't do the things to the ambitious degree that we do them now.
I mean, because it's a behemoth now. It's massive.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
It's one of the biggest online
it?
Brands there is.
Absolutely. And hugely successful in terms of its adaptation to how things are paid for right now.
Well, in terms of strategic partnerships and
yes.
that kind of thing.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, the Vulture Festival, as well as, you know, you know, there are a couple of different ways you can get advertising. And one of the ways is a more sort of direct sponsorship. You know, the sponsor definitely wants to be in partner with your brand as opposed to sort of, you know, going through sort of Google or one of these other sort of, you know, commoditized advertising, you know, organizations, which is not as just doesn't pay as well. So they've done a really brilliant job of that. And so one of the things that I began a process of, which is now continued, you know, after my leaving, was trying to sort of figure out, well, what does the partnership between our online business and our print business, you know, what does it mean in terms of journalistically? Like, what are you looking for to appear in print? And some of that really was just like, you know, you deal a lot with Hollywood publicists and things like that, and they do want to be in print because it sort of seems more prestigious. It still does to this day. So some of that we still work with. You know, we say, well, you know, you can appear in print in the magazine, and you know, and that's sort of also part of that game ultimately.
What have been the lowlights then over the last 14 years, other than the election of Trump? We can go into that later.
I mean, you know, I think, you know, there have been really. You know, it's been challenges. I mean, it really is hard to. It was hard to go biweekly. It was hard to sort of realize.
It's a huge change, isn't it? I mean, it's easy to just think, well, it's going from 1 week to fortnightly, as we would say. But
yes.
Actually, it changes the nature of everything, doesn't it?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. I mean, the way it isn't different is we do close the magazine on Friday. For the following Monday, so we still do have a very quick turnaround, which is just like it's not like we close it and it sits around for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a month or
yeah, because a lot of monthly magazines have incredibly long lead times.
Yeah.
Like
they're
planning their December, their Christmas coverage even now in July.
You can't believe it, and you're thinking that it has no relationship to
what to reality,
exactly reality.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it requires more planning. Implicitly, it requires the material that's in there to be better, and I think we've achieved that. I mean, I think that we've achieved a sense that that the magazine content, the magazine print content, has become more refined than it had been previously. The other thing is, we always think now in print, what will this do online? You know, how can we make a national impact? And I will tell you, when I write something or when I edit something that appears in print, it doesn't matter that's in print, and it doesn't get talked about until it appears online.
The reality is that, in a sense, whilst print is more prestigious, and that's
yes.
what the advertisers and the commercial partners want,
yes.
it actually doesn't have anywhere near the impact, as you've said, until it's online. Because, I mean, where can you buy New York Magazine physically? I mean, largely here in Manhattan and certain newsagents, you
yes.
know, around the US. I can even get it in London.
Yes.
But you can't get it on every newsstand, whereas online, you've got a huge readership.
Absolutely. And some of that... Now, in terms of like of people commenting on things and sort of that sort of feeling that's in the news, some of that's just because the people who comment online. So, you know, in some ways, you know, it is a little bit of a closed circle. Like, you know, are people reading it in print? Absolutely. But there's no mechanism for them to comment reading in print. So,
do you remember letters to the editor, just like the old way of doing it?
Exactly. Well, you know, and we gave up letters to the editor years ago and sort of, you know, did this sort of comments page, which sort of like is a sort of melange of you know,
printable.
Twitter commentary and
what's
other people.
Sane and printable.
Yes, exactly. But it's, you know, it is really interesting. I mean, you know, we do the magazine itself, the physical magazine, the cover is very important still because it does, although it isn't something that necessarily is there to sell on the newsstand like it used to be. And we used to really worry about that. Now we worry about that less. But what we want to do is we want to make sure that it has a poster-like quality. It has this sort of idea that, you know, this is what we're saying. This is important.
A physical banner ad.
You know, we did this piece not so long ago by Jonathan Shade about the relationship between, like, sort of patterning out, you know, the relationship between Trump and Putin. And so we had this this rather famous artist named Barbara Kruger do a cover. And it, you know, it really is, you know, it's kind of been everywhere online. It sort of did sort of do a nice job of sort of summing up the idea of the piece. And, you know, and that piece, of course, landed, you know, the week of the summit and caused a certain amount of trouble.
I mean, you guys know Trump of old, as you said earlier in this conversation. You must be particularly flabbergasted to see him, you know, in the White House.
Yes. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it was surprising to see that, you know, he managed to, and he's a master marketer, that he managed to sort of create an idea of himself. And I think really in partnership with a lot of other media companies, including Fox News, that made sense to people. You know, it really makes sense to listen. A lot of my family's from the American South, right? And we have a lot of relatives that, and I've written about this. You know, who voted for Trump. You know, he talks about in a way that, for whatever reason, they think is authentic and makes sense to them. And it's hard. It's hard for someone like, I mean, one of the things that, that definitely the has happened to the magazine in the last, you know, last few years is that we've become more partisan. We've become more a part of that particular bubble.
But it's not necessarily party political in the right. sense of that it's not Democrat nor Republican, because really you're just standing up for, you know, a commander-in-chief who doesn't lie and doesn't demean his colleagues,
well,
doesn't
we'd like
sexually
to think
assault
so.
Women.
We'd like to think so, yes. I mean, absolutely. But I think that, you know, that, that in effect within the way that our sort of media and political culture works right now, we've sort of taken a side.
He seems to have created and cultivated an image of being an outsider, because if you think, you know, Manhattan billionaire socialite
oh,
guy
absolutely.
That he was, you would think that in a sense he's the ultimate kind of part of the establishment, that he wants everything. But, you know, you talk to maybe your relatives, I'm not trying to put words in their mouth, but they would say actually because he's got independent wealth, that means he's not in hock to the deep state, the big banks, the big corporations.
That was certainly one of the arguments, absolutely.
You know, without you, you haven't brought your crystal ball with you. But what's next? You know, I know lots of Democrats that didn't like Hillary, for example, and mm-hmm. thought, well, you know, they're both as bad as each other. And that used to flabbergast me even at
absolutely.
The time, because I thought there's a risk that this guy might win. Obviously he did. Do you think that the Democrats are going to get their act together? Do you think the people that maybe liked Hillary but didn't like her enough to go out and vote for her because they thought her winning was a foregone conclusion, as indeed Hillary said herself in her book, do you think that ultimately those all of the various parts of society that were arguably complacent have had the jolt that they need to get rid of that big time?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. It's so hard to know what things are moving so quickly now that I think it'll be impossible for at this point for us to know what it's all going to look like in November, much less
what it's all going to look like next week.
Yeah, I don't think we really know.
It's like no one knows anything anymore.
Yes. I mean, there's a lot of distraction. You know, there's a lot of and I think that, you know, one of the things I think that's been really interesting about, you know, about the media is that you kind of always have to be sort of like on deck now. You know, our and to take, for example, The Cut. OK, The Cut was started out, I think, you know, originally as a it came out of our fashion coverage. And then there was sort of an idea that it should also cover other women's issues.
So you've got 8 million unique visitors at the moment.
Amazing.
I mean, it's insane. And
they're
you're
really
doing huge
successful.
Amounts on the gender equality debate, as I'm sure you're about to say.
Yeah, absolutely. And they have become, and that's been sort of with their sort of entry point, I think, into becoming a very particular voice in the broader American culture. And yes, some of that does appear in the magazine. Rebecca Traceder, who's one of their leading voices in that, she's helped define the terms of this discussion. They were the ones that the you know that even sort of smaller sort of scuffles, like there was an organization called this phenomenon called the Shitty Media Men List, and then the person who wrote that, who came up with that, and it was sort of like calling out a bunch of men in the media, came forward on The Cut. That's been really powerful.
Mm.
And it's interesting because the Cut has a political point of view, and that's something that that quite frankly surprised me as watching that develop. I didn't think that they would do that. But they cover I think that, you know, it's hard, I think, for women especially, to see, you know, things like Donald Trump's, you know, comments during the election, and then see him get elected anyway. And it really sort of galvanized people. And so you can have your you know, this is a really interesting new shoe and this is about the latest Kim Kardashian kerfluffle, but also have serious and thoughtful political coverage.
There's a risk, though, to that strategy, arguably commercially. I mean, first of all, I agree with you. I applaud mm-hmm. it. I think
yeah.
it's fantastic what you're doing. But there's the kind of Taylor Swift strategy, which is to not get involved in politics. Yes,
right.
Yes, she's not challenged the president. Her view might be privately. There's other people doing that. And all she's going to do is alienate, you know, half of her audience or the families
sure.
of her audience if she says anything.
Right.
Which brings me to the point, which is the opposite of that, which is when the Dixie Chicks waded in about the Iraq War, if you remember,
right.
and George
oh,
W.
Golly,
Bush.
Yes, yes.
They lost huge amounts of fans because of that, because
mm-hmm.
they said, look, just shut up about politics and get on the stage and sing your songs. Now, I feel sorry for the Dixie Chicks, because I'm actually quite a fan of them, actually. I listened to their album earlier today. But you can see why it might be better to stay out of politics, like the Cut. In a sense, another CEO might say, just stick to the shoes and the fashion. Because are you going to create a lot of highly motivated, alienated people that are then going to try and challenge you and you get bogged down in all that kind of
I don't think that you can compare the Dixie Chicks to a journalistic operation. I think that one of the things that
I had a damn good go. I thought.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think that it's. I think that that's really what they're trying to do. I mean, I think that they, you know, they realize what their readership is interested in, and I think that they realize, you know, what bothers them. And
so it's attracting and reinforcing the existing readership rather than alienating a huge group of people that wouldn't have been there anyway.
My guess is yes. But all I know is it's been successful. And I think they haven't done it in a cheap way. And I think if you look over at, you know, one of the only successes online at Condé Nast was Teen Vogue. And Teen Vogue was, you know, I mean, it was about social justice, and I think that when you look at, especially for a younger, as a millennial audience, social justice is one of the main motivating ideas in their lives. You know, being involved, making a difference, and fortunately, I guess really unfortunately, there's a lot of fodder for that right now, and to ignore that is to ignore both your mission, and I think also in some ways you're ignoring the potential. The commercial potential of your organization to try to sort of stay. And admittedly, like, listen, I was not my original. My original sort of instinct is to be a little bit, a little ironic, a little distant, a little bit. I think just because that was sort of, you know, how I was sort of brought up journalistically. But it isn't the way that that people are now. If anything, you know, what you have to do is you have to make sure that any sort of stands you take or any sort of stands writers take, and especially online, you have a lot of stuff that's happening, you know, isn't just sort of jumping on a bandwagon, but is you have to make sure that it has rigor. And that to my mind, is the biggest challenge right now.
Yeah, because how do you actually do that? I mean, it's about having unique voices, though, isn't it, and empowering them, to, you know, on your platform so that they can say what's needed. Because otherwise, unless you have that uniqueness, then you're just joining in the chorus of disapproval of whatever.
But you have a cut voice. I don't think we have. I mean, there are individual voices within that. There are certainly writers here who I'm especially a fan of because of the way they could sort of, you know, turn a phrase or think of that. Even people who are tasked with sort of writing as many as multiple times a day. But ultimately, like, you know, in terms of the reader, what the reader wants, I think, is to trust what the brand says, and the writers all have to live up to that trust. And people really do. They talk about the cut. They don't talk about, I mean, they talk about Rebecca Traceder because she's a star and unbelievably articulate in what she's saying. But, you know, a lot of times what's going on here is that they do trust the cut's sort of take on things. And whether that's just to reassure them in some ways you know, in the face of all these sort of challenges, that there are people who are, you know, who are sort of, I don't know, thinking it through for them. I don't know.
I do think you're right. I think the cut has a tone. It has a voice. How do you create that? How do you engender it? How, if you're one of the custodians of that, how do you do it? I mean, I'm thinking of like TV shows. When you get a TV show's created, the creator will create a show bible that says, here's the characters and here's the scenarios. This is what they do. This is what they would never do and so on. Is there a kind of hidden 5 or 6 page style guide or tone guide about what the cut is about and what it would do and what it wouldn't do?
Well, you know, most of it's edited, and some of it's edited more thoroughly than other parts of it. A lot of attention is paid to the framing, the headlines. I mean, one of the interesting things that you have to do when you're editing now, and this is something that didn't used to be the case in the least, is you had to think, okay, well, what is it that will cause someone to pass this piece along? What is it this piece is saying?
The shareability.
Yeah, and what is it saying about you that you share it? And that, I think, is really interesting. So you have to sort of, in some ways, have an idea of, you know, I mean, I guess sort of like a pitch line for the story. You know, what is it that people are going to think about it? And if it's too muddled or too, then it won't work in social.
One of the ways that we grow our listenership on this podcast is that the guests themselves, you know, tweet that they've been on it. It's a great mm-hmm. source of new traffic. I'm hoping you'll tweet that you were on this, but you may well not. It depends. So, but is that in a sense that your readers are your marketers now? That a large volume of new traffic is your readers sharing with their co-workers, colleagues, friends,
absolutely,
associates.
And I think to some extent also, and this is what I tell young journalists now. You know, is it part of your job is marketing? You're a marketer for your material. I mean, and you have to think about that. I mean, you can't sort of count on the reputation of, for example, New York Magazine being the sort of the thing you must read to allow what you do to succeed. And that is a completely different perspective, I think, on journalism than certainly when I started. And, you know, I remember friends in the, you know, who work at the New York Times, who work in politics there, who would say, and this was early on in the campaign, say, oh, no, no, we're definitely encouraged to write about Trump as often as possible because it always does well. Now, you could ask whether that contributed to his being elected, and I would say probably. But it also, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, but it's just the way it is, the way that, you know, one of the considerations, you know, that is you know, for a piece, you know, is how well will it do? You know, one of but sometimes things will surprise you. I mean, our number one piece last year called the Doomed Earth Catalog. It basically took seven looks at ways in which the world, our world, would no longer be, you know, hospitable to human habitation.
I read it. It wasn't an upbeat article, as I recall. There weren't many laughs in it.
No, there were not many laughs in it. And, you know, what's really interesting about that piece was I at first had feared that it was a piece that would come across as being self-indulgent.
Yeah, self-indulgent. Yeah, agreed.
And
it didn't.
But it didn't. I mean, not only is because the writer is an elegant writer, but also because there was something about its relentlessness.
It was interesting. I know that's almost sounds insipid to say as a criticism, but, you know, I want to read stuff I want to read. I don't want to read stuff that I ought to be reading or feel some sense of duty to read.
Oh, absolutely.
I want to be pulled toward it.
Now, let's also say that, like, we are a bit of a fan of an apocalyptic narrative. I mean, there was a reason why there was a piece that in the New Yorker about sort of what tsunamis that were going to destroy Seattle a few years back by Catherine Schultz, which also did very well.
It's wild. If I ever moved to Seattle, I'd only ever live at the top of the Space Needle.
It'll fall into the water.
I'll never go there ever again. Then. That's the plan B.
But it really is. I mean, so some of it was so evocative about that. And that is that's very powerful. You know, it wasn't like a piece of journalism where he went anywhere, really. He didn't really sort of like, you know, do other than have like a bunch of phone calls with very smart people. And then it was interesting, and this comes back to her point about the role of social media, is that some of the people he talked to thought he had exaggerated what they had said. And it caused this a bunch of articles being written about it in other publications, measuring that, weighing that out.
Great. And great PR for that article.
And that was not in any sort of sense the idea, the cynical idea of it. But it did help the discussion going.
Of course. And if you really linked to the source material.
And if you really read the piece, its point was that scientists, for whatever reason, which he sort of goes into sort of psychoanalyzing them a little bit, didn't want to say things were as bad as they were. So in some ways, the whole piece was a critique of scientists,
self-censoring.
Science, yeah, and then that played out in this discussion. But you know, he was worried enough about it that afterwards he actually did an annotated version of the piece that actually tried to go through and talk about it. And now he's writing a book about it. So you know, that was a piece that I think many publications might not have done.
Do you think social media is now so important to the work of a journalist that there's almost been a generation that have got caught out by it? That, like, I mean, don't get me wrong, the digital strategy that you guys have got is incredible. You've adapted, you've engaged, you've turned it into a positive. But there are some journalists that just haven't quite got it. I know some incredible journalists that are, you know, earth-shatteringly great and have like 300 followers on Twitter because they've never been a Twitter person engaging and causing a furore.
And let's face it, I mean, you know, being a Twitter person does not make you a good journalist.
No.
And in some sense, it can be the opposite. I mean, but it is also true that especially as a young journalist, it's difficult to get hired unless you have a certain amount of fluency with that. I'm not as good as it as other people are, but partly because I think that one of the things you have to do is have a consistent perspective, often about a consistent. And I kind of write about all kinds of things. So, like, you know, if you have somebody who, like me, who will write about an artist and then write about, like, the future of shopping in the digital age and then write about a movie star or write about, you know, I'm kind of, like, all over the place. I'm sort of, like, sort of drop me in where they want. It's harder to sort of know, oh, well, this is, you know, the person to listen to about this.
Is the death of the generalist journalist at hand then? I mean, should everyone, every journalist have a specialism?
It could be. It really is very helpful to do that. One of the people I think is really interesting, well, there are two people I'm really fascinated with in terms of like how they've adapted as older people to Twitter. If you're not adapted to it and you're like under 30, I don't know what's wrong with you, but because you never existed without it. But there's a woman named Emily Nussbaum, who's now the TV critic for The New Yorker. And she worked with us for a long time. And she actually was the culture editor at one point. And then she also did the and then eventually sort of, you know, she became our sort of TV critic, and then she became The New Yorker's. But she will engage anybody. She'll just volley back and forth, just sit there and talk to people. And this kind of comes back to one of the other things that has happened is that, you know, is and this is something that she's sort of a part of, and I think Vulture is a part of, which is that people want to talk to other people about what they're reading and watching and listening to. And that people want that sort of sense of community. You know, that didn't obviously exist previously. Maybe you talked to a few of your friends about TV shows you wanted to do. Well, but you,
the
you
sense of community seemed to exist in the past, even as recently as 10, 20, 30 years ago. It was in your local geographic community, in the street, in your neighbours. Now, people avoid eye contact with the people in the same building, and they're building up communities on the cut and around interests rather than geography.
Absolutely. You know, I think some of that is just because people move around more than they used to, but I think that it is it's also totally true. I mean, I think that sometimes you wonder how people actually are able, especially younger people, you kind of think, do you know how to talk to somebody, or can you only talk through the phone, you know?
A lot of young people don't even like picking up the phone to speak on it.
Oh, and I think that's...
God, we sound like verbal giffers now.
No, but it is really true. I mean, that is a weakness about journalism today. And that is, there's a lot of journalism which is, you know, takes place via email. It takes place oftentimes as sort of layers of commentary on things, as opposed to actually going somewhere and talking to somebody. And you can't get around that. You can't get around... You know, that is as a way of sort of actually finding out something.
So good old fashioned shoe leather, knocking on doors.
Yes.
What's going on? Tell me
absolutely.
Your story.
No, I mean, and you wouldn't like. I mean, and the stories that really made a difference, the Time story about you know, a lot of the Me Too stuff about and a friend of mine was involved in the you know, one of those stories, and she was talking about how she would. I mean, they literally, you know, they did. You know, just multiple phone calls, leaving notes with people, you know, like trying to find friends of friends, you know, forcing that story to light. And that's something you'll never do, emailing people.
Agreed. But the speed of which the Me Too movement came out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can remember when Ashley Judd wrote that article, and I remember reading it thinking, wow, that was incredibly brave. I hope that doesn't get forgotten about quickly. Mm-hmm. Yes. That needs to lead to something.
Yes.
And then within 3 weeks, Weinstein was charged with rape. He'd resigned. You know, there was all these kind of things that had...
Absolutely.
I mean, it's just the speed with which some of the, you know, some of the tenets of society is collapsing, like that sexism. I hope it gets fixed. But in the meantime, it seems that it's blown wide open now, and so quickly.
Absolutely. And it really is a it's changed all kinds of expectations that I think people have. And I think to some extent it's changed sympathies. You know, it's a lot of why you wouldn't write about those things previously if they were sort of known. And if you've been around, you know, you quote-unquote know about Donald Trump. You quote-unquote know about, you know, Harvey Weinstein. But no one wrote about it because they, you know, there was a powerful publicity apparatus around them that would keep you from doing the other things that were deemed necessary as part of your job if you didn't, you know, if you didn't play along or if you tried to sort of do a gossipier story. And that somehow got blown apart. And that's really interesting. I mean, it's a fundamentally different set of protections for people than previously. And this is one of the points that that Rebecca always makes, Rebecca Traceder, is that there was a why do we automatically have the sympathies that we have? Why do we think that this person deserves to be successful? And her answer is, you know, is the patriarchy, basically, is plain old fashioned sexism.
I mean, we had this in the United Kingdom with the Leveson inquiry, that the UK press was just far too close to the Metropolitan Police and to the police generally.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they were just having cosy chats, exchanging incredibly confidential information.
Absolutely.
To the point where the press were breaking the law, hacking phones and all kinds of things, and the police were tacitly turning a blind eye to it because it's that cosy relationship suited both sides.
Absolutely. And that's, yeah, that's totally, that was fascinating. I mean, you know, the tabloid culture in London is something that you don't, that's present in New York, but almost nowhere else in this country, mostly of single newspaper towns. But, you know, in the end, it's true. I mean, you know, there are certain kinds of exchanges that do take place inevitably in journalism.
Last couple of questions then. Where is print going?
You know, I do think that print, you know, is very important because I do think that there is a sense of finality to it. You know, I think that's important, I think, both to our brand as New York Magazine, as well as, I think, to a number of other brands. You know, I mean, but as always, I mean, the biggest challenge is something that that we don't really think about, I think, as civilians anyway, don't really think about, is just advertising. You know, there just isn't the same. Advertising is sort of divided up among all these different places now, so that it isn't as supported as it used to be. But I do think that will continue, and I do think that will be an important part of, I think, people's diets, you know, at least for serious journalism.
Last question then. Where are you going? You've been 14 years where you are now. If it's not too personal a question, do you have any plans to move on? What will you do next?
That's a really good question. I mean, it's something that I can't say that I don't think about.
Of course. Well, that's the most honest anyone's ever been so far. Everyone said, I'm very happy where I am and giving it no thought whatsoever.
Well, I mean, I really like, you know, New York Magazine. I've been given tremendous opportunities there.
And, huge fan of the magazine. Huge fan of your writing.
And I've enjoyed the opportunities I have to sort of like find different parts of the world, find different things. You know, but you know, the journalism world has certainly changed since I started out, and in order to sort of remain, you know, vital within it, you have to sort of be able to sort of adapt to it. And I have friends, you know, I spent the weekend actually with a friend who used to write for New York Magazine who now makes documentary films. You know, I have another friend who used to, you know, be a staff writer actually at the magazine and then took off and started making podcasts that apparently was
madness lies therein, I can assure you. Anyone who makes podcasts, none of them are ever happy, I can assure you.
And I think that, you know, I think there obviously, you know, there are a lot of opportunities to tell stories in different ways these days. And but, you know, my first love is writing, and I love being able to sort of write something that you know, that changes the way, that deepens someone's understanding of something and changes the way that that they live in the world in some small way. And that's when I'm editing, that's the same thing I'm after. And New York Magazine is one of the places where you can do that. I mean, you know, and that's one of the things that that it sort of is a great gift of the place.
Carl, I'm a huge fan of the magazine and a huge fan of your writing in particular. It's been great that you've taken the time to come and talk with us. Thank you ever so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.